What are the stories you tell yourself? Unless we take the time and effort to recognize and examine these stories, we're unlikely to realize that much of what guides our beliefs and behaviors is just that, stories, not truth. This week, I talk with Tammy Heerman, a fellow coach and author of the book, Reframe Your Story, Real Talk for Women Who Want to Let Go, Do Less, and Be More, together. Here, we talk about the importance of mindset and the power of talking about the human experience at work. The vast majority of us, regardless of gender, share the same fears. We just manage them differently. When we understand that, it can help us to boost our own confidence and make more empowered choices about how we show up. Thank you so much, as always, for listening. Welcome to the Imposter Syndrome Files. My name is Kim Menninger, and as an executive coach and former high-tech leader, my personal mission is to help professionals overcome imposter syndrome so that you can advance your career with confidence. Each week, I interview a new guest who brings a powerful perspective to this conversation, including personal stories, best practices, and new insights. The more we talk about this issue, the more we destigmatize imposter syndrome, recognize that we're not alone, and empower ourselves to access the tools and resources that can help us and those around us. Thank you so much for listening and for sharing with others you think would benefit from this conversation. Welcome, Tammy. I could not be more excited for this conversation. I've been looking forward to it since you and I first connected, and I would love to start by inviting you to introduce yourself.
Sure. Thanks, Kim. I'm excited for today, too. Tammy Heerman, I am on a mission to have the world replace the age-old stereotype of think manager, think male with think leadership, think female. And so I'm lucky enough to spend my days working with and for women, the advancement of women in the workplace and kind of reshaping their opportunities, and also the managers that support them. I think we'll probably get into this, but organizations do not spend enough time really working with the managers that need to support women and, of course, all minority groups. But that's me. I spend my time keynotes, workshops, coaching, and loving every minute of it.
And I love the think leadership, think female. And I would love to hear more about how you got here. What's your own story of like what led you down this path?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of was a bit of a job hunter. So by way of background, I come with a business degree and I really specialized my graduate studies kind of in human resources and change management. But then I kind of hopped around from sector to sector and job to job. And what I realized is a person who became my boss and is now a dear friend said to me, "Wow, no organization could keep you really interested long enough, could they?" And that's kind of one of the moments where I went, yeah, I really love learning. And I love helping other people kind of, you know, embrace kind of learning and change. And so that's kind of how I got into the world of training and development, leadership development. And then one day, I was leading the practice at a global human capital consulting firm for leadership development. And my CEO at the time came to me and said, "Tammy, my buddy, you know, has this daughter and she just bought this organization that does, you know, motivational luncheons for women, but she really wants to help, you know, move the numbers and they need a leadership development partner. So make it work." And he just left my desk. And so I was stuck with this project to make it work of something that didn't fit at all into our business model. This was a kind of a bums in seat, you know, business of training for women. We didn't do that work. We did high-end consulting and you know, here I was. And so I was kind of having the, oh, great kind of moment. But then as I worked with the women, as I started into the research, as I lived the same journey as I was hearing from all the other women, you know, trying to get promoted with a toddler clinging to your leg and juggling work and home and everything, you know, crying in the bathroom on occasion. It really became a passion for me because I thought it can't be like this anymore and we can't feel so alone. And so that's really what started my dedicated work in working for the advancement of women.
And just everything you said is so familiar. And I wonder, you know, it's interesting. I started my career in the high-tech industry in the late 90s. I left when my older son was born, decided to take a change in direction into entrepreneurship. And I wonder, you know, do you feel like we're making progress? Like, how would you assess today's environment, right? I know it's a big question, but I'm just curious because there are times when I feel like doing this work is so inspiring and other times when I just want to curl up in the fetal position and be like, oh, this is so hard.
Yes. Yes, yes, and yes. So do I feel like we're making progress? So the numbers would say no, right? If you look at any of the metrics, certainly you and I would account for North America, but it, you know, anywhere kind of in the Western world and actually anywhere, the numbers would say no, we're not, we slide up, we slide down, we're still only about, let's say 20 to 30% for most of the world. So the numbers would say no, but I think what has changed is our willingness to have open dialogue around human things, you know, everything from starting the pandemic with mental health to menopause, which has become a mainstream, you know, topic now. And thanks to all the good work that's coming out of the UK. But I think we're making progress on our ability to kind of have conversations about what we want the world to look like. So is progress fast enough? Absolutely not. I think both you and I would agree with that. But I feel we're making baby steps. And really, what other choice do we have, Kim, you know, in terms of kind of keeping going?
I agree. And I think that is the way that I think about it. What keeps me sane is that it is beyond our individual control to a large extent how fast these system changes move. But where I try to focus is on personal power and what we can be doing as individuals, the choices that we make about whether to stay, how to show up, how to respond to different kinds of situations. And I wonder if you have thoughts on, like, what are the... And this is a big question too, so we can break it down, but what are the biggest opportunities that you see for women today in terms of sort of embracing their own power in the recognizing that progress is too slow, recognizing that it's really hard. It's the navigating these environments can be very challenging. What kinds of things do you generally advise people to do or think about to feel more personally in control of their own situations?
Absolutely. So in your question, I think you hit on a couple of critical things that I resonate with and why it keeps me in this work too, is when I can work with individuals or small groups and they can feel that shift in control, that they feel that they have some control and choice. And so right now I'm actually working with eight women right now who are working one of the big four consulting firms and they're up for, you know, either partner or managing director. And the biggest shift I see in working with them is reframing their mindset around things like, you know, I have to wait to be told to speak up. I don't know as much as the other people in the room. I'm not in that positional power yet. So what, you know, what right do I have? And then on the other hand, everyone's saying, you know, their leaders and managers are saying, well, we're just waiting for her to step up. And so there's this disconnect between waiting for permission and waiting to speak up. And I experienced that myself too. I remember with an old boss, well, I was just waiting for you to do this. And so when I talk to them about reframing their mindset, it's about understanding, you know, what are you waiting for? And you know, and you have so much expertise and wisdom and information and all of that to offer right now. And so where I derive my pleasure, and I think where we can make the biggest movement personally, is the one woman said to me, I realized as I started to pay attention that they don't really know the answer either. You know, they're just leading the conversation. They're just got, you know, she's looking at these partners going, they actually don't know as much as I thought they did. And it was such a big aha for her to realize that. But until she started looking for it and how to kind of navigate situations where we're facilitating a conversation versus expected to know the answer, that was a huge shift for many of them, actually.
I love that. I've heard similar comments from people that I've worked with as well about, wow, they're not as smart as I thought they were, right? But when they get out of their own head and start paying attention to what's actually being said, it's like, oh, there is such a thing as a stupid question. But one of the things that I think about a lot is how much of this is rooted in socialization of girls, right? Of being obedient, following the rules, really kind of understanding your place. That whole theme of waiting to be invited into the conversation instead of just taking that initiative, I think traces back so far into our early childhood and just implicit and explicit messages that we got from our parents, from society at large. And so it seems simple to say, just speak up, right? Just do it. But on the other hand, there's this strong force that says, this is just not the right thing for me, that I'm going to be punished in some way for doing it. I'd love your thoughts on the mindset piece, because I think this is so important, is how do we tell ourselves a different story?
Yeah. So what I love, but what you said about the socialization piece is that I've been using that now, that understanding, as a relief for people saying, okay. And so I'll continue with the example. I remember the women asking a male senior partner in the room, he's about to retire. And so, you know, they were soaking up his wisdom. And they said, well, can you tell us about a time, you know, when you were afraid? And he looked at them, he said, every single day, I'm afraid that I'm not going to bring the money in to feed the partnership, that I'm not. And their faces kind of, they didn't expect that from a, you know, an old gray haired male, almost upon retirement partner. And so what I talk to women about is the socialization piece. Nearly everyone feels fear. Nearly everyone has this imposter syndrome. We've just been socialized to deal with it differently. So for girls, stay back, stay safe, don't speak up. Whereas boys, if they feel the fear, push through, be brave, man up, all of those things. But we both have the fear. And so to me, that should be a sense of relief. And so reframing is, does this story serve me anymore? How do we all learn to kind of push through that fear in ways that is certainly authentic to ourselves in terms of our own timing and pacing, but not to say I'm not going to do it at all? And so I've been kind of reframing this sense of differences in socialization around, let's take this as good news, because we thought inherently, well, if they're doing it, then they must be better, smarter, this, that. And that's not the case at all. They're just pushing through the fear faster. That's all. Mm-hmm. And so let's go, oh, okay, I can do that too. It doesn't mean inherently that there's something inferior about me, which I think is how we feel a lot of the times. And certainly society is telling us that.
Oh, that is such a great reframe. I love that as understanding the socialization is almost liberating, right? Because I wish there were more of those gray-haired men willing to say that.
I know.
Because I think that goes back to what you were talking about with the dialogue about human things, right? Because I do think one of the challenges is that we often sit in these rooms and everyone's putting on a brave face, and we can't see what's actually going on behind the scenes. So we're making these assumptions that everyone else is so much smarter and more confident, and everyone else has it all figured out, and there must be something wrong with me. Whereas that vulnerability, that willingness to say, no, actually, I'm afraid too, and I just manage it differently, means we can just accept at face value that the fear is going to be there.
Yeah.
And then we get to make choices about what we do with that.
Exactly. And that's why, and I don't know if you experience this, Kim, but so many organizations still ask me, you know, do we need these separate programs for women? And isn't it kind of counterintuitive, kind of separating them out when we're trying to integrate everyone, blah, 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 blah. And yes, we do need these programs, because these are the kinds of conversations that I think we have and are willing to have in a room full of women. Like, nothing is better than in a room full of women. And you're reminding me of a story. And I tell this in my book, that there was a woman kind of standing up. She was kind of giving a little presentation I was having her give. And all of a sudden she just stopped and started crying. And so, you know, I stopped the video recording and I said, "What story are you telling yourself right now?" And to your point of, we compare ourselves, and she was looking around and she said, "I don't even know what I'm doing here. You know, I don't feel like I'm the same leader as her and her and her. Like, I don't even know what I'm doing here." And the women were all just staring at her going, "Are you kidding me?" And this one woman in sales, who of course is more gregarious and open, and said, "I sell things. I lead a team that sells things. You invent things." She was one of the scientists at the organization. And if she didn't exist in her role, they wouldn't have things to sell and market and, you know, operationalize. And so I think these kinds of conversations are so critical, and we need to create environments to have them, to have more vulnerable human conversations, to get these mindset pieces out.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I do a lot of women-specific programming too, and the power of normalizing and sharing in those very vulnerable, candid ways cannot be overstated. I think that one of the biggest benefits is people walk away feeling like it's not just me.
Exactly.
And they get to see it. And it's just so interesting to create space for someone to say, "You, like, I look at you as the person," right? And then we all realize, like, I often joke that part of managing our self-doubt and imposter syndrome is revealing the absurdity of our thinking. And that, I think, ties back to the stories we tell ourselves, right? Because they're so deeply ingrained in us. We accept them at face value. We don't really take them out and examine them. It's just kind of our operating system. And then once we start saying it out loud, we think, like, "Wait a second, that kind of sounds ridiculous when I say it." And when we hear it, we get to have a conversation with somebody else, it updates. It gives us a chance to think about it from a new perspective.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, you kind of asked me about mindset earlier, and this is where I think the training and development, learning development world, leadership development world has failed, is that we all go into these workshops or these experiences and we're taught skills and we check the box and we go home. And what I mean by that, and I've been in these workshops too. You sit there and you look at the facilitator and you go, "I could never do it like you. I could never be like you." And all these stories, like, I could never do that. I'd never say that. I'd never ask that person for a meeting, whatever the content is. And we self-talk ourselves into going, "Okay, I'm just going to sit through this day or 2 days or half day or 2 hours, and then I'll be on my way and my manager will know I attended and good for me." And rather than saying, "Okay, let's take this topic, whatever it might be, and say, what are all the," what was the term you used? I loved it. Absurdity. You're thinking about this. And I laughed because, back to my opening story, when I said, you know, I started partnering this with this women's organization. Well, I taught a workshop on networking, and I'm one of the most introverted people that you can meet. And I started off by saying, "Hi, I'm Tammy, and I hate networking." And they all just stared at me in panic, thinking, "Oh my God, I just paid for this workshop." And what? And I said, "If you didn't feel the same way, I suspect you wouldn't be here. So I'm going to talk to you." I said, "You'd hate if I was someone up here who said, 'I love it. It's awesome. Go talk to people, work the room.'" I said, "You'd hate that." I said, "So let's talk about all the things you're telling yourself. Let's talk about how people like us, who would rather hide in the corner by the buffet table, do this." Right. And I think that's where we need to take these experiences and first start with, okay, what's your values, beliefs, and mindset telling you as you walk into these situations? That's where the learning has to start. Otherwise, it's a waste of time.
Oh, you're so right. Like, I've been talking about that when I talk about my work lately. The way I've been describing it is, I think about it through the lens of what makes it hard to be human, right? And I say almost exactly what you just said, which is, there's so many trainings that are focused on skill building, but I think about it from the lens of, yeah, I know what I'm technically supposed to do, but what do I do when I know that, but I still I feel like an imposter. I get really anxious. I don't feel psychologically safe enough to do it. Let's get to the real heart of what's going on. We all know how to learn. We wouldn't be in the workplace if that weren't true. We all have intelligence. This is not about intelligence. This is about mindset. This is about how we see ourselves in relationship to those around us.
Oh, Kim, you and I need to do a project together. It would be so fun.
I know. You've got my wheels turning. This is such a great conversation. I got to ask you this because I think this is important too. Where do men fit into this discussion?
Well, everywhere, right? So I start off by saying, you know, and work with the organizations and the managers who support them. And if we're being honest, if we're working in most organizations, when we talk to kind of the management and leadership, it tends to be very heavily male dominated. And so I think the days of, you know, putting people through unconscious bias workshops and all that, like, it's not working. And so some of the organizations that I've seen do this the best don't even, you know, broadcast that they're doing things necessarily in the diversity and inclusion realm. They just bake it into everything they do as a leadership expectation. So for example, if they're doing a hiring workshop, then they just kind of reforecast that and they don't go, and now we're going to talk about the diversity. No, like everything is baked right in terms of this is how we do things. So we really need to kind of recalibrate what leadership expectations are and not you know, make big fanfare of it. Just this is the way it is. And I think for men, so one of the most seminal experiences I had is this was a big pharmaceutical company. And again, it was probably about the top 100 leaders. The vast majority were men. And when I kind of shared with them, you know, some of the research, and so let's go back to networking as an example, you know, and I said that, you know, women and men, certainly research shows build networks differently. For women, it's more psychosocial support. For men, it's more, you know, this and that. And I said, I had some compelling research that talked about women don't like to leverage their networks, that in fact, you know, phoning up someone and saying, hey, can you introduce me to them? Or can you do me a solid or whatever it is abhorrent. There was actually a German executive study that used the word unmoralisch. So it's immoral to do that. Well, is it? No, it's not immoral. Of course it's not. But this is kind of how we're thinking about it. And the CEO was just flabbergasted. And he stood up and he said, my commitment today to this leadership team is to bring you all into my networks. He said, it never even dawned on me that the people in this room aren't doing the same things that I'm doing. It never dawned on me that you wouldn't just ask to come to a meeting or pick up the phone and ask to be or this or that or whatever it may be. He said, I had no idea. And see, so I will actively open and bring you to these things. So I think part of it is about how do we just talk about what some of the research has shown about how we approach these things differently, why we do, how we've been socialized differently, and what impact it's having. And sure, a lot of people, you know, some people will say, no, I don't believe that, whatever, this is crap. But I think the majority want to help. So many senior men have said to me, Tammy, just tell me what to do. Just tell me how to help once they understand what the implications are.
I hear the same thing. I completely agree. And I think that is the missing piece is how do we create space that still protects the sort of sacred nature of these women's groups and programming that we're talking about, but also gives men a window into what our stories are. Because you're absolutely right that it's not just about us. It's if I have a manager who doesn't understand that I'm not speaking up in a meeting, not because I don't have anything to share or, you know, I'm not as engaged as my counterparts. It's because I'm not quite sure what the appropriate protocol is. That might be misinterpreted by my manager as lack of ambition or lack of commitment or lack of readiness for that next opportunity. Whereas if my manager understands, like the CEO that you're describing, no, actually, there may be a different reason why she's behaving that way. And maybe by proactively inviting her and letting her know that I understand this, that will change that dynamic. And so making sure that they have enough visibility, because so often we're having conversations with each other and we're all nodding our heads and we're getting so much value from it. But if they don't see it, they can't understand or change it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you kind of asked earlier about kind of how we begin to change our mindset. So of course that's a big question, but one of the things that I've been having the women experiment a lot with, and I use it myself, is, you know, first kind of setting your intent for even like a conversation. We go into a million conversations and meetings a week. We're constantly, that's the format of our work lives, as conversations. And so what's my intent for that? And so many times we're focused on kind of the content, and we need to be focused on the how. So not just what I want to say, but how I want to be. And I use a lot of mantras, and I don't care what you call them, talk tracks, slogans, whatever resonates with the person. But just that extra little oomph of saying, I belong here. I know stuff, you know, you're not going to throw me, whatever it is, whatever you need for that situation, to keep that in our mind, and then focus on how we want to be, not just what and the content. Because we're so focused on trying to sound smart or say the right thing. And really, we need to just buoy our power to be there as an equal.
I feel like you're my brain twin. I love this, because you're absolutely right. And I think this goes back to some of the socialization, because I think women are really great students for the most part, right? Just really good at, okay, I know that the topic of this meeting is going to be X, so I'm going to cram as if I'm preparing for an exam. I'm going to just study so that I know all of it. You know, I'm not going to be blindsided by a question I can't answer, even though that's not realistic, right? That's where the focus lies, as opposed to, as you're saying, what's my intention for this meeting? How do I want people to experience me in this conversation? What is my purpose for being in this conversation in the first place? Because for me, so often I was focused on what I didn't know and how much smarter all of the people around me were, that I felt so inadequate when I finally realized, like, oh, I'm not here to compete with Bob from engineering. That's his job, right? That's not why I'm here. And so to really try to zoom out a little bit and take that meta level view, as opposed to just the, what is the substance of the meeting, as you're talking about.
Absolutely. And I've seen, and I love the shift when the women I work with realize that, right? Like, it's so empowering for them. Oh my God. Okay, I really only have to say a couple things, and I really just have to, you know, facilitate. I just have to ask a good question sometimes, or right. And to when that pressure is off, oh, I love seeing that.
Yes, exactly. And I say this all the time too, because every new challenge feels like the big one, right? Well, I've survived all the other ones, but this is going to be the time. This is going to be the one, right, that brings me down. And I think it often gets tied to these things like, oh, do I know enough? Am I prepared enough? And one of the things that I will say is, you may not know everything about the topic that you're just entering into now, the conversation you're entering into now, but here are three things you definitely already know how to do. You know how to learn, you know how to problem solve, and you know how to be resourceful. You wouldn't have gotten to where you are without those three things. And so if you don't know the answer to one question, it doesn't mean that you don't belong in that room, right? You can find it. You can figure it out. And so I think it's really redefining what success looks like in the moment.
Absolutely. I've been doing a really fun activity with people lately, and maybe your listeners want to try it for themselves. And I call it a kind of a rapid fire strengths piece. So, you know, you just mentioned three really great ones for someone. I challenge, and sometimes if we're online, I'll have them do it in the chat, and I'll say, what are you an expert in? And they just, they panic. I'm not, because all of a sudden we think of Nobel Prize winning, Olympic gold medal, you know, and it's like, no. Of a handful of people that you'll meet in your area, you can confidently say you're the top one or two, not in the world, in your sphere of it, you know? And so what are you an expert at? Okay. And then they'll put something, and like, again, and I just have them rapid fire things that you can confidently say. And even, you know, things like, people can show me a color and I'll tell them what it's called. open the fridge. I can make you a gourmet meal out of anything you have, you know, like, and again, and again, and again. And the purpose is to really rewire our brains. And I think you mentioned it, that we always go to what we don't know, how the insecurities we do feel versus, you know, I'm amazing. I'm this, I'm that, I have all these things and I'll figure it out. I'll figure it out. And it's not the end of the world. And so I love that kind of brain rewiring exercise to kind of get us in that place of feeling really great about what we are.
Yeah, and I love the rapid fire nature of it too, because it almost forces you not to second guess. Cause I think women often say, well, would other people say I'm an expert at this? Right. Like, try to be really precise and quantify, like, what is my actual expertise, especially, like you said, compared to these Nobel Prize winners. But you're right. I love that. It, you know, just what do I do better than most? Right. Keep it simple. But I think too that there's this feeling of, oh, well, that just sounds like obnoxious. It sounds cocky and arrogant, as opposed to recognizing it as, no, if I know what I do uniquely well, then I can bring that and be of greatest service to my team, right? I can, and I always like to think about that distinction between service and ego. This is not about me being wonderful or thinking that, you know, having everyone else think I'm wonderful. It's about how can I, everybody wants to feel like they're making an impact. Everybody wants to feel like they're doing something valuable. Well, I can't effectively do that if I don't know what I uniquely bring into this, you know, sort of puzzle, right?
Yeah. That's one of the other areas, certainly when I'm working with high potentials and they're kind of looking for that next step, that ability to kind of speak in the eye and own their, you know, strengths. And that is such a hard thing, more so for women to do. And so, yeah, we do a lot of practicing and retraining of the I and we and all of that good stuff. Because I think so often we think, well, we're throwing our team under the bus or others if we don't give credit to the team. And I said, well, of course you're going to give credit. And of course, and of course, and of course. And in that moment, they're not up for promotion. You are. And so, yeah, I spend a lot of time with those kind of looking for that next step to really step into that place of discomfort. But you know what's neat? And Kim, I don't know if you've come across this, but I have seen a lot of interesting research that men also feel discomfort in that sharing of strengths and accomplishments. And yet again, socialization would say, well, it's a benefit, so do it anyway. And so they do it anyway. And so I have seen that this isn't an area of comfort necessarily for anyone. And yet we look at others and go, wow, they're so comfortable. And sometimes it does feel arrogant when we kind of see others do it in a way, but then let's call it for what it is: arrogance, conceit. There's a difference in the small people who are doing that versus confidently owning your capabilities. So I think there's a lot to kind of rethink there as well.
I love that. I think that's really important for us to know, because one of the things that I often say too is that we confuse confidence with strength and arrogance, and that when you see people show up in this way of just sort of obnoxiously tooting their own horn or bragging, whatever you want to call it, that's not confidence, right? True confidence is quiet. If you know what you're good at, you're humble enough to recognize where your strengths lie and where they don't, you don't have to be flexing your muscles and sort of peacocking around in front of other people, right? And so I think too that to not confuse that with sort of positive strength, it's a reflection of their own insecurities. And I think that just hearing that research kind of makes you think like, oh, now I get it, right? Because we haven't really been taught, or we don't have great role models for what productive, positive self-promotion looks like, that we're all uncomfortable and we're all trying to figure it out in different ways. And then we still haven't quite cracked the code yet.
I actually wrote a really neat article on that, and people can find it on LinkedIn. After speaking with a colleague of mine who's a great kind of former executive and coach, and he was talking to me about humility. And when I looked it up, humility is actually rooted in self-confidence. And yet somehow we've turned it into a word, be humble, to combat arrogance and conceit. And it actually, the root of the word is not that at all. And so I forget what I wrote, but I put something like arrogance has shamed humility. And really, humility is it's not a thing that needs to rectify arrogance. It's a thing we need to bolster our own confidence. And even understanding that, I was like, wow, that's really interesting how we've taken this word and kind of, shaped it for the very few who need to be humbled. And of course, we know those that have that bravado actually are at their root, likely, self-deprecated, they're not as confident as they should be, so they're putting on that bravado. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting piece that I got from my colleague and kind of decided to write about.
I can't wait to check that out, because I think the common theme that runs through everything that we're talking about is just that don't accept what you see at face value, because there's so much more complexity to it, and that we're all struggling. Each and every one of us, we have our own set of fears and insecurities. Many of them overlap. Many of them are rooted in our own personal journeys and experiences. We see the world through our own filters. But the more we understand that we're all doing this, right, the less it feels like a me problem and more of a human thing that we just have to, we have to manage. Yeah. It doesn't make us inferior or deficient in some way.
Well, you know what else has helped though? Who's figured this out? Athletes, professional performers, like they know their head game, the stories they tell themselves, all of that, their mindset is probably even more important than their physical game or performance. And that's what's led to performance coaches and, sports psychologists and all that. And you only have to look in any news feed to see all of the athletes and performers that have pulled out because of their head game. And it's like, okay, so we get that. We all go, oh yeah, we understand that. Why do we not think it works for us in our office cubicles and our basement offices? And like, of course the same concepts apply. And so for me, again, that was a big relief to say, okay, the tennis pros and the pop stars and everything pulling out, that should, and the gymnasts, and that should make us go, oh, okay, it's okay for all of us to examine our mindsets and our stories and our pressures and all of these things. So again, I think we can learn from those that are a lot more public about it now. And I'm not just talking about mental health. I'm talking about like literally getting yourself in the game for your performance, whether that's a presentation or a conversation with your boss or whatever it may be. And so I think that's kind of been a cool thing that's come out of these last few years as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that you're right to just expand the way we see those stories, and not as sort of these isolated incidents in this other sphere, but a sort of a universal message about humanity and how can we think about that in terms of our own experience. Yeah. Oh my gosh, Tammy, I could seriously talk to you all day, and we will definitely continue our conversation offline, I'm sure. But in the meantime, where can people find you if they want to learn more about you, see what you see your work? You wrote a book too.
I did. And it's called Reframe Your Story. It's real talk for women who want to let go, do less, and be more together. And so you hear me use the word reframe a lot, because that's a lot of what I work with. But that's available on Amazon and all major bookstores. You can find me at tammyhearman.com. That's two E's, two N's, or on LinkedIn or Instagram. So yeah, I'd love to connect with people.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This has been such an inspiring conversation. I'm so grateful to have you here.
Me as well. Thanks so much, Kim.
Thanks so much for listening to the Imposter Syndrome Files. If you would like to continue this conversation in a safe and trusted space, I would love for you to join my virtual discussion group every Thursday at 12 p.m. Eastern. For the past several years, the group has been limited to women, but it is now open, regardless of gender, to anyone who is interested in exploring and troubleshooting common workplace challenges, building better awareness of ourselves and others, and becoming more inclusive allies at work. Check out the show notes for more info on how to find us. And please join us next week for another episode of the Imposter Syndrome Files.